Roe v. Wade is over. Roe v. Wade is finished. As we mentioned at the 9:30, the Lord gave us five courageous justices. They were five, not six. The sixth one upheld the Mississippi law, which was good, but he didn't take the additional step of reversing that wicked, cruel, murderous opinion from almost 50 years ago, Roe versus Wade. We had five who did that. Five justices who need our prayers for protection because many seek their harm and their death. And so God is the one who we celebrate this morning, the one who we praise, because make no mistake, God delivers. And in this case, he delivers the unborn from that opinion from almost 50 years ago. God is a God who is sovereign. God is a God who is gracious. And so today we celebrate what God did 48 hours ago in reversing that opinion. And we also celebrate, as I mentioned at the 9:30, that we live in Texas. This is just one more reason to thank God that you live in Texas. Because under that opinion, the court, as it always should have done, left the matter to the states. As the 10th Amendment says, all other rights are reserved to the states unless the right is specifically granted in the Constitution, unless the provision is specifically granted in the Constitution. And of course, abortion is conspicuously missing from the Constitution. And so it's a matter always to be deferred to the states. And so we live in a state, praise God, that honors life. And so in this state, we're going to have a different approach to the unborn in the mother's womb, which should be the safest place for a child, right? In her or his mother's womb. So we celebrate today, and it's fascinating to see the Lord's timing, because again, as I mentioned at the 9:30, John Tyler, who is our special guest speaker today, he and I didn't put our calendars together to figure out, let's have you come out 48 hours after the Supreme Court overrules Roe v. Wade. Because John is a religious liberty, a constitutional expert. John was a lawyer, a litigator, a trial lawyer for many, many years. And then he ended his practice of law, at least his practice of law in the courthouse, and he went to school. He went to school to study what in the world is happening in our nation in terms of the progressive movement's rapid, successful, and I use the word successful carefully, successful efforts in terms of undermining the biblical principles of this nation, undermining the foundation of our nation. The progressive movement has been on fire, and they have so many successes. And so John went to school to study, why is that happening? John is now a professor. He was first a professor at Texas A&M University, and now he's a professor at Houston Baptist University. And I look forward to the presentation that John is going to give us today. He gave part of his presentation at the 9:30. He's presenting to us the biblical basis, the historical basis of our constitutional rights, with an emphasis on the right of our religious liberty, the right to worship, and all the aspects of the religious liberty that we have in our Constitution, because that one is key. That's the linchpin to all the other rights. When that one goes, all the others fall like dominoes. And so John's going to talk to us about all of this. And as well, he's going to talk to us about the progressive movement's attack on those liberties that the Lord has given us through the Constitution of these United States of America. And with that, I will turn it over to John.
Thank you, Alan. It's such an honor to be here today in this beautiful part of the state and to celebrate this wonderful decision that he was just talking about. My name is John Tyler. I'm a professor of law and a professor of philosophy at Houston Baptist University. Earlier this morning, we made three main points with regard to religious liberty and the scriptural basis for religious liberty. First, we saw that God created man in his own likeness, and gave man, among other characteristics, freedom. Man sinned and lost that freedom, and then Christ came, made his sacrifice to restore that freedom for us. Second, we saw that religious liberty is important because of the commands that Christ gives us in how to worship him. We're commanded to study the scriptures. We're commanded to pray without ceasing. We're commanded to assemble ourselves together. We're commanded to live our lives in obedience to God's commands. And third, we saw that religious liberty is important because God commands us in Scripture to help others find redemption as well. So we're commanded to go forth and preach the gospel, and we're commanded also to fulfill Christ's great commission. And the conclusion that we have from there is that the Bible absolutely supports religious liberty. And in fact, religious liberty is a very integral part of God's plan so far as we help others come to Christ ourselves. Now this morning, I want to talk about three new topics. First, I want to explain how God has a plan for our country, and he gives us that plan in Scripture. Second, I want to explain how our nation established religious liberty at our founding so that we could accomplish God's plan. And third, I want to bring a warning. Our religious liberty in our country is under the greatest threat in the entire history of our nation, and it's up to us to maintain our religious liberty. Now, our country has a plan, and we know from Scripture, we're all familiar that God has a plan for each of our individual lives. But we also know from Scripture that God has a plan for nations in history as well. And we know, for instance, that God originally had a plan for Israel. God entered into a covenant with Israel because he wanted Israel to be a nation of priests and a separate people. And he wanted the world to see what blessings came when you were obedient to God, but he also wanted the world to see what discipline would come if you disobeyed God. Now, unfortunately, we all know the story, the sad story, that Israel broke that covenant many, many times. And ultimately, God disciplined them first by the kingdom splitting in two. And then, in 721 BC, the Assyrians conquered the northern kingdom and took the Jews into captivity. And then, in 586 BC, the Babylonians conquered the southern kingdom and took them into captivity. Now, today, we're no longer under the covenant that the Jews had. We're under a new covenant because we've had the great blessing of Christ coming and dying on the cross. And although we're not under the Mosaic covenant anymore, we are under a new covenant, and God gives us that covenant in the Great Commission, as we've already read today. And so, I'll read from it. Jesus came up and spoke to them, saying that all authority has been given to me on heaven and on earth. And he told us to go forth and make disciples of all the nations and to teach all the nations all that he had commanded us. And I'm here to tell you today that America was founded not to perpetuate slavery, as is being taught at every university in our country today. But our country was founded specifically for the purpose of fulfilling the Great Commission. And I'm a lawyer, and I don't make statements without evidence. So what I want to do today is I want to go to the original founding documents of our country and show you how this is true. So the very, very first document in the founding of our country was the Virginia Charter that the king issued for the founding of the American colonies on April 10th in 1606. Now, it's named the Virginia Charter, but Virginia was the name of all 13 colonies originally. And this charter covers the land from the southern border of South Carolina all the way to the northernmost tip of Maine. And we see by looking at it, the language that's in red here, that the purpose of the founding of the American colonies was for propagating or spreading the Christian religion to such people as yet live in darkness and miserable ignorance of the true knowledge and worship of God. In other words, the purpose of the founding of the American colonies was to fulfill the Great Commission. Now I want to look at the second great founding, the second document of our founding, which is the Mayflower Compact. Now, many of you know the story of the Mayflower, and it's so familiar to you that it may have lost some of its impact. But I want you, if you would, to think for a second that you're one of the pilgrims. When you're a Puritan in England has passed a law giving it the death penalty, giving you the death penalty for being a Puritan. In order to escape that, you fled to Holland, and you lived in Holland for 12 years with a different culture, who people didn't even speak your language. And then, when Holland took away religious liberty, you made the decision to come to this uncharted wilderness in 1620 in order to find religious liberty, not fame or wealth or power, but just to be free to worship God. Think of what kind of person that takes. Now, because you got a late start, you're going to come in two ships, and one of them kept leaking, and you kept going back to harbor to try to get it fixed. You ended up coming late, and you had 66 days on a ship that was 109 feet long and 25 feet wide at its widest part. 25 feet. You are one of 103 passengers, plus 30 crewmen, plus all the pigs and sheep and goats and cattle that you want to bring to the New World. And after 66 days, during the 66 days, there were days when nobody could stand up. Everybody was so seasick because of the storms. And one of your passengers was actually swept over and lost during one of the storms. So you now come and you've got a nice, clear, sunny day, and you're looking over the side of the ship, and there's this beautiful land with no storms, with no shaking back and forth, no seasickness. I could not wait to get off of that ship if I'd been one of those people. But before they got off the ship, they got together and they said, we need to write a contract, or in old English, a compact, that's going to state why we came here so that people will know and how we're going to govern ourselves. And so this then is the famous Mayflower Compact, and this is the original handwritten copy that was written and signed by everyone before a single person stepped off of that ship. And if you look at the second paragraph up there, let's see if I can hide it right here, this language, what it says, that they undertook this voyage for three reasons: the glory of God, the advancement of the Christian faith, and the honor of their king and country. So this, we see, the pilgrims came here also to fulfill God's command in the Great Commission. Now, religious liberty is one of five liberties in the First Amendment. So I want to read this language to you, and then we're going to be talking about each of these provisions as we go on later during the day. So the First Amendment of the Constitution, it was passed in 1791, but what most people don't know is that it was the fruit of 4 centuries of struggle for religious liberty. Every one of these rights came out of a struggle, not for freedom of speech or freedom of the press, but out of the struggle for religious liberty. So the first phrase up here, Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. Now, this first clause, the Establishment Clause, holds that the government cannot establish a state religion. And this was very important because governments throughout history tried to control religion as a means of controlling people. The second clause, the Free Exercise Clause, holds that government cannot tell you what you have to believe. They cannot tell you how you have to worship, and they cannot tell you how you have to live your life in regard to your faith. Now, 1791 was 4 centuries after this struggle started, and I want to illustrate this 4-century struggle by the lives of the two men who were the most important or greatest influences in the founding of our country. The first man, this is a picture, the only picture we have, of a man named William Tyndale. The book that was most cited by our founders in their writings, and there are scholars who study this at length, by far the number one book was the English language Bible. And the English language Bible that we have is a result of the work of Tyndale during his life. His life should be a movie. It was filled with secret agents and chase scenes, living underground, and finally a heartbreaking betrayal by someone that he thought was his best friend. Translating the Bible in his day was very, very dangerous. Many people don't know this, but in England, the Roman Catholic Church in 1401 got a statute passed. The name of the statute is On the Burning of Heretics. And what the statute provided was that if you had just one word of the Bible in English, you would be burned alive. I went to Coventry, England to stand on the spot where a woman named Joan Wise she was a widow with 7 children. She was burned alive and her children left on the streets because she had taught them the Lord's Prayer in English. They found a copy of it in her sleeve, and so they burned her for it. So the idea of translating the entire Bible into English was very, very dangerous. But Tyndale wanted to do it because he knew the Bible tells us to search the Scriptures and to study the Scriptures. And no one could do that in England because the only Bible that was available was in Latin. So in 1522, Tyndale was ordained. He was a scholar at Oxford. He was ordained a Roman Catholic priest. And that's the same year that Martin Luther in Germany translated the New Testament into German. So Tyndale wanted to translate the Bible into English, and he went to his bishop, Bishop of London, Cuthbert Tunstall, and asked permission. And the bishop said, absolutely not. And furthermore, if you try, we're going to burn you at the stake. So he then found some German merchants that would pay for him to go to Germany, and he began an underground effort to publish, to translate the Bible and publish it. If you read through his life, he'll get a book or two translated and have it published, and while the ink is still wet, secret agents would pursue him and he'd have to flee from Worms to Cologne to city after city, never knowing if the next day was going to be his last. So he did this for 11 years until finally he was betrayed by a man named Henry Phillips. Now during all this time, secret agents from the King of England, from the Bishop of London, from the Holy Roman Empire and the Catholic Church had pursued him, and he had dodged them all this time. But finally he's betrayed by Phillips and turned over to the Holy Roman Empire. They turned him over to the Roman Inquisition. The Inquisition was a trial that was not about finding guilt or innocence. The whole purpose of the Inquisition was to force someone to say that they had been a heretic and wrong for disagreeing with the Church. So instead of putting him to death right away after they convicted him, they put him in a dungeon for 500 days. They deprived him of food and water, almost starved him to death, gave him no coats or blankets during the bitter Belgian winter, and after 500 days, they finally decided they were licked. No matter what they did, Tyndale was never going to stand up in a church and say that he'd been wrong to translate the Bible into English. So then they decided to execute him, and this is a famous woodcut from Matthew Fox's Book of Martyrs. Which is a wonderful book and historically very accurate. And you'll see here, he is standing up against a stake. This is taking place at a castle called Valvoorde right outside Antwerp, Belgium. And if you see this cartoon language right there, his last words were a prayer to God. And he said, Lord, please open the King of England's eyes. And what he meant by that was he wanted Henry VIII to allow the Bible to be translated into English and then to be published in England. Because of this, he was put to death. Unusually for the Inquisition, because they had so much respect for him, instead of burning him alive, they strangled him first. That was a rare privilege, if you can call that a privilege. Then they burned his body, and then the Inquisition took his body's remains, the ashes and the bones, and they blew it up with gunpowder because in their belief, they believed that they blew it up with gunpowder, not even God Almighty could give Tyndale a resurrection body. That's how vindictive they were. Now, 3 years later, Tyndale's prayer was answered. So his death and his life were not in vain. And Henry VIII then not only permitted the translation of the Bible into English, he ordered it to be done. And he ordered no fewer than 9,000 copies of Tyndale's Bible and had them published, and it's called the Great Bible because it was more than 2 feet across. And he ordered one of these Bibles to be placed in every church in England so that every man, woman, and child could come and read the Bible for themselves. 83% of the words in the King James Version that were published in 1611, 83% of the words come directly from Tyndale. So he is a great giant of the faith. Now, the Bible was the book that the founders relied on more than any other book, but the author that they relied on more than any other author is this man. His name is John Locke. I was visiting with several of you about John Locke during the break. John Locke, apart from his role in the American founding, is considered one of the 10 most important philosophers in the entire history of philosophy that goes back to 700 BC. He was a brilliant man, one of the world's leading philosophers still today. But he was also a physician. He was also a committed Christian, a Puritan, who believed that the Bible was God's inerrant message to man. Now, Locke is going to write, Locke was a very great advocate, not only of political liberty, but of religious liberty as well. And because of that, he was targeted by the King of England for death. And I know that you'll be shocked to hear that people in politics will use hoax allegations against political figures to try to persecute them. But that's exactly what happened. There was a hoax made up that there was going to be an assassination attempt on the king. And what happened was, one after another, the king's political enemies, all of whom were Christians, were targeted, put to death after a bogus trial with false, perjured evidence and corrupt judges. And when they came for John Locke, John Locke got the word ahead, he was warned, and so he then fled to Holland, where he had to live for 7 years, from 1683 till 1689. But Locke's life is a great example of God's promise in Romans 8:28, that all things will work together for good to those that love God, that are called according to his purpose. And if he had not been there during this time, he probably would have not written the two books that were the most important books in our founding, and probably the two most important books on political theory in the history of the world. The first one is a book called The Second Treatise on Government, and that book gave 100% of the ideas in the Declaration of Independence. Thomas Jefferson acknowledged it. He said he thought it was the greatest book on politics, and so he copied Locke's works. If Jefferson were to turn in the Declaration of Independence in one of my classes, I'd have to give him an F for plagiarism, because about 80% of the actual words come from Locke's book on the Second Treatise of Government. Another very important book he wrote that was radical at the time was a book called A Letter Concerning Toleration, in which he argued that government should get out of religion and let people have religious freedom. And that book became the basis for our First Amendment guarantee of religious freedom. Now, Locke believed that religious liberty was the most important liberty for two reasons. The first, obviously, is religious liberty allows us to fulfill God's commands and fulfill the Great Commission. But there's a second, more subtle reason, and the reason for that is that we learn from history and we learn from law that political liberty and religious liberty are inseparable. When religious liberty rises, the other political liberties rise as well. And when religious liberty is destroyed, the other liberties will be destroyed as well. So what I want to do now is to illustrate to you the truth of that. And so, looking at the First Amendment again, we've talked about the Establishment Clause and the Free Exercise Clause, and I've illustrated that those came from the struggle for religious liberty that William Tyndale and John Locke were involved in. Now, our second clause is that Congress will make no law abridging the freedom of speech. So how did the freedom of speech arise out of a four-century struggle for religious liberty? And the answer to that question is this man, who you may not recognize, but this man's name is John Bunyan. And I'm sure you'll recognize the name of his book, A Pilgrim's Progress. This book is only about 80 pages long. It was published more than 400 years ago, and it has never been out of print. It's been published in more than 220 languages, and it is considered the world's greatest allegory in the history of world literature. The amazing thing about this is he wrote it in prison. Now, he went to prison for committing a crime, and the crime he committed was that he preached the gospel of Jesus Christ without being ordained by the government-run church. See, the church wanted to control everybody who could be ordained because they wanted to control the content of what the preachers were going to say. And for this, he was put in prison in a town called Bedford in central England, and he was there for 12 years. And this man's personality was as attractive as his works, his literary works was. And his jailers absolutely fell in love with the guy. And they would come to him every day and say, John, we don't want you in prison anymore. Please promise us that you won't preach anymore so we can let you go today. And he said no. And he had a blind daughter, and his family was starving. And his daughter became sick and died while he was in prison. The jailers came to him and said, be with your daughter. He said, no, the Lord's called me to preach the gospel, and if you let me go, I'm going to do that. So he stayed in prison day after day after day for 12 years. And while he was there, God's plan for his life was to complete the Pilgrim's Progress. And the Pilgrim's Progress has been a life-changing force for at least a dozen people that I know, because I gave them copies of it and they hadn't read it, and several of them converted to Christianity after reading it. It's a wonderful little work, and the theme of it is about the need for perseverance in your Christian walk. But let me tell you what's so inspiring for me about John Bunyan is that John Bunyan made his living repairing used pots and pans. He was a tinker. He lived on the edge of poverty and starvation all of his life. And although he wrote one of the great masterpieces of world literature, he did not even have a second grade education. So it shows me you don't have to be rich or famous or powerful or even have a college degree to be used mightily for the kingdom. God can use anybody who's prepared. He shows the difference one person can make. Now, our next right is freedom of the press. So how is freedom of the press related to the struggle for religious liberty? Well, the answer to this is William Brewster. And you may not know who he is, but William Brewster was the number two man in Queen Elizabeth's State Department. And he was a very high-level diplomat and made a number of trips to Holland on important government business. But when Elizabeth died, England passed a statute making it a crime to be a Puritan. The name of the statute is the Act Against Puritans. And some Puritans were put to death simply because they wanted to hold their own church services outside of the state-run church. Now, Brewster lost his job in the State Department because he was a Puritan, so he moved close to York in the very northern part of England, almost to Scotland, and there he became head of a Puritan congregation called the Scrooby Congregation, because that's the house that they met in. And because of persecution, many of them were arrested, tortured by King James I. Finally, they decided, Brewster led them to Holland to try to find religious freedom. Now, when he was there in Holland, he set up a printing press, and he would use it to print Puritan Christian works that he'd send back to England. And when King James's agents found him, they pressured the Dutch government to arrest Brewster and put him to death and to shut down his printing press. Well, the Dutch did shut down the printing press, and they did arrest Brewster, but they let him go, and he escaped. And the day that they shut down his printing press, that was the day that he decided that the Scrooby congregation would get on the Mayflower and come to the New World. And this is the man who made that decision happen. What's the lesson of John Bunyan's life? We see that there is no religious liberty without freedom of speech. What's the lesson of William Brewster's life? We see that there's no religious liberty without freedom of the press as well. Now, the next right is the right of the people peaceably to assemble. And when my students are first exposed in my common law courses to these, that they always say, well, how do these don't seem associated with each other. How did this happen? And each of these rights came from the struggle for religious liberty. So the person who illustrates how this came from the struggle of religious liberty is this man, William Penn. Now, I often say my mother was a nurse, and she believed in the virtue of oatmeal. 365 days a year, I hated oatmeal. I hate it today. I know it's healthy. But every morning, I had to stare at this man's face on the Quaker Oats as I was eating my gruel each day. So I grew up with a very negative opinion of William Penn until I learned his life story. So William Penn was a Quaker. He came from an extremely important family in England. His father was the Lord High Admiral, the highest-ranking military figure in the entire English nation. He was raised in an Anglican Church of England family, but when he was a young man, he converted to become a Quaker. And at the time that I'm going to tell you about, he's 23 years old. He's 6'5 at a time. I'm 5'10 on my tiptoes, and I would have been considered a tall guy back in England this time. But he was 6'3", 6'4", and so he was easy to pick out. One day, England passes a law, an act against heretics, an act against Puritans. They also passed a law, an act against Quakers. They hated the Quakers more than any other religious group, which is hard to believe because I've known some Quakers, and I like them all, right, except for the William Penn. But One of the things they hated about him was they didn't recognize class structure in society. They believed with a vengeance that God created all men equal. They don't even have preachers in their services. And they refused to bow to the king or to take their hat off in the king's presence. And this, for some reason, just drove the English crazy. So they passed this law against him. Now, William Penn is walking down the street in London with another Quaker friend of his, and he's easy to recognize. He was considered very handsome, brilliant speaker, brilliant man. And so a man came up to him, a very affable personality, and starts asking him, you know, what do you believe as a Quaker? And so William Penn answered his questions. And then another person came up, and another person came up, and soon there were more than 300 people listening to Penn, asking him questions, and he's very patiently answering all their questions. Well, England had another religious statute called the Conventicle Act, and this made it a crime. Think of this. It made it a crime to have any religious discussion with a group of five or more people unless it was conducted as part of an official state-run church service in England. And it was a serious crime because the penalty was you would be put into slavery working on sugar plantations in the Caribbean. And hundreds of men were sent there as slaves, and there's not a single historical record of a single one that survived the slavery. So it was very much a death penalty by hard labor. So the mayor of London particularly hated Quakers, and to curry favor with the king, he appointed himself to be the judge for a very important lawsuit for William Penn, the criminal prosecution. And so the judge, they had the trial, and at the end of the evidence, the judge told the jury, y'all go back there and y'all bring me a guilty verdict. And the jury went back there and they came back, and guess what they did? They defied the judge and said, no, not guilty. Made the judge furious. He sent them back a second time. They came back a second time, not guilty. Next, he took away their water, their food, and their tobacco. I find that very interesting. In the court records, when you read the court records, and sent them back and said, don't come back until you give me, and also no chamber pots. Don't come back until you give me a guilty verdict. And they came back a third time, and it infuriated the judge. He said, y'all going to go back a fourth time? If you don't give me a guilty verdict, then I'm going to put you in prison and give you a fine. And you have to stay in prison until you pay the fine. So you know what happened? The jury comes back a fourth time and says, not only no, but heck no. He's innocent. And the judge kept his promise. And he put every one of these people into prison with a large fine and said, you're going to stay there until you pay the fine. Well, William Penn's father came, and he knew about this, of course. And so he offered to pay the fine for each one of these brave jurors. And all but one took him up on it. But one man named Edmund Bushell. And I've been in the spot where this trial took place in the Old Bailey in England. He said, no, I'm not going to pay the fine. He hired a lawyer and filed what we call a habeas corpus action against this judge, challenging the judge's power to force the jury to come back with a guilty verdict. And he won the case. And this case, Bushell's case, is one of the most important cases in the history of the world because it established that English people had a right to an impartial jury. And our Sixth Amendment has that right preserved for criminal juries, and just to make sure no one doubted it, you get a right to an impartial jury under the Seventh Amendment in civil cases as well. As my wife said, that shows the difference that one brave person can make. So the lesson of this is that unless you have freedom of assembly, peaceable assembly, you really can't have religious freedom either. And we also learn that unless you have right to an impartial jury trial, you're not going to have religious liberty either. And then our last right that I want to talk about was the freedom to petition the government for a redress of grievances. And students have no idea what this talks about. But there's a very, very important story, and maybe the second most important case in the history of English law involves these men. These are known as the seven bishops. These are the portraits of seven Anglican bishops that were very brave in this case. And you'll see how brave they are when I tell you what they went through. The King of England, there's a new king named James II that came to power in 1683. His father had been Charles I, who had been put to death by Cromwell. And he was Roman Catholic, even though it was illegal to be a Roman Catholic king. But he got foolish Parliament to grant him taxes for life. And so as soon as Parliament did that, he disbanded Parliament so that there was no legislative branch of the English government. And then he did something that was completely illegal. Under English law, the king could not control the army except during time of actual warfare, except for 13 days a year for training. But he raised an illegal private army, paid for with these taxes, of more than 60,000 people. And he did something that rings true. Remember, we just had a Second Amendment case from the Supreme Court a week or two ago. Okay? He used his illegal private army under Roman Catholic command to go through England and disarm all the Protestants. Guess what he did after all the Protestants were disarmed? He then announced that he was no longer going to follow any of the laws in England, that he was going to rule as a tyrant, and that he was going to enforce his will with this illegal army. And on top of that, he was going to force everyone in England, now at this time 99% or more are Protestant, to convert to Roman Catholicism. Now these seven bishops were very brave. They had a legal right that England had recognized for more than 800 years to petition the king. So they filed a legal petition to the king saying, King, please reconsider what you're doing. You don't have the legal right to do it, and it contradicts the Constitution. And the king's reaction, because the people were disarmed, was not to follow the law, but he had them arrested. And he tried them for a crime known as sedition and libel. Now let me tell you what they faced if they were convicted. If you've ever seen the stocks, like when I take my kid to Williamsburg, you know, they all stick their head in, we take pictures and that. But they were real things. They were going to be placed in these stocks, and while they were in the stocks, the executioner would slice both of their nostrils all the way down. Next, he would cut off their ears as close as he could to the skull. Next, he would brand them with a brand on each cheek about this big. It was a large circle, and in the circle were the letters S and L for sedition and libel. And sometimes the cruel executioners would brand people upside down. They did this with Puritans a lot, and then say they'd made a mistake and branded them a second time. And some Puritans, a man named William Prynne, a famous lawyer, they left holes in both of his cheeks for the rest of his life. So he walked around basically without a nose, without ears, and with holes in both his cheeks, and he had to have handkerchiefs here. That was just the beginning. On top of this, the punishment would be a fine of more than $1 million in our money today. On top of that, their university degrees would be taken away, and they would be barred from ever holding a church office again. And then on top of that, life imprisonment. So these are the punishments that these men faced. And what did they do? All they did was file a legal petition asking the king to reconsider his illegal actions. So this is a famous painting that hangs in Parliament. And right here, this gentleman right here is standing up, and he's holding a piece of paper in his hand. All of England held its breath while this case took place 2 days in May. Crowds outside courtroom building. And I've been to the place where this was actually tried and stood in these spots. It inspires me to do that. And this man is holding the verdict, and he's announcing and reading it that it is, even though they had corrupt judges trying to get a conviction, because the king could fire and hire judges at will, the jury finds them not guilty. Now, there was such a widespread celebration, all of the Navy ships on the Thames fired off their guns over and over again. We have live accounts of what happened. Every church in England started ringing its bells for more than an hour to celebrate this. And the people were so upset now with the king that the king realized he had to flee for his life. So he fled to France, and that was the end of the Stuart kings, tyrannical kings, and never came back to England again. And after that, something we call the Glorious Revolution soon followed, which is hugely important for our Constitution. We call it the Glorious Revolution because the revolution that happened in England, not a single person was killed. But there's a second reason. As a result of the Glorious Revolution, England passed their own Bill of Rights. And no fewer than 43 provisions of our Bill of Rights come from this English Bill of Rights, including free speech, right to impartial jury, and very, very importantly, the right to bear arms. So this is the origin of the right to bear arms. It's not to protect ourselves from each other, it's to protect ourselves from tyrannical rulers. This is why, by the way, the progressives target the Second Amendment over and over again and try to get rid of it every time they can. So what do we learn from the seven bishops? If you don't have the right to petition the government for redress of grievances, you're not going to have full religious liberty either. And if I had more time, as I do with my students, I could take you through every one of the 40 rights in the Bill of Rights, and I could tell you a similar story about how every one of these rights came from the struggle over 400 years for religious liberty. Now, that brings me to my final point today, which is I have to bring you a warning that our religious liberty is under threat, and we are on the verge, depending on how the elections go, of perhaps losing it. I want to explain that to you. The First Amendment, the provision that guarantees religious liberty, and all the other 39 rights in our Bill of Rights, up until 1990, received a level of legal protection called strict scrutiny. I'm not going to bore you with the technical definition. It's the highest protection for any right recognized by our law. In 1990, the U.S. Supreme Court took away strict scrutiny protection from just one of those rights. It's the right for religious liberty. So now, the First Amendment does not protect Congress from violating our religious liberty. All they have to show is that Congress did not intend and did not name, for instance, Fredericksburg Bible Church as the target. But they could keep you from going to church by saying that your street is unsafe outside. And these are the games that get played all the time. Remember Gavin Newsom, the governor of California, shut down all the churches in California because of COVID. That was just the excuse that he wanted. Now, the name of this case is Employment Division versus Smith, and this is the first page of the opinion right there. And this case opened the door then for the enemies of Christianity to attack religious liberty. So I want to talk a little bit, not at length, about the progressive war against religious liberty. This is a page I took off yesterday from the Congressional Progressive Caucus. The people who are attacking our religious liberty call themselves the Progressive Movement. The Progressive Caucus is the largest caucus in the United States Congress, the largest one. It has 100 members from the House of Representatives, and it has one senator. And the senator is Bernie Sanders, who is a Marxist, a communist, and he was the one who founded this caucus immediately after that Supreme Court decision. And the caucus was founded primarily for the reason of destroying your religious liberty and your Christian faith. So you'll notice, I need to point this out, two members of the so-called squad are in leadership positions in this caucus. Now, I'm going to tell you about the progressives and what they believe, and let me tell you how I know this. When I was a lawyer in 2008, my poor wife thought I had lost my mind. I had a very successful practice, and I walked away from it to go get a PhD in philosophy. All my law partners were very unhappy with me as well. But I had seen at this point, from 1990 to 2008, how successful the progressives had been in dismantling our rights and our liberties, how the judges were changing and the judges were leaning their way. And I couldn't make sense of it. I couldn't understand it at all. But I ended up being accepted to study for my doctorate with a very famous philosopher who's the world's leading expert on John Dewey, an American philosopher that died in 1952. Dewey is considered the head or the founder of the progressive movement. So from the studies, I was able to discern then what their motive is and why they're bringing this attack on our Christianity. So they believe five basic things. First of all, they do not believe in the existence of the Christian God. They actually have published works in which they say that belief in Christian God is just as silly, and these are their words, as believing in leprechauns, fairies, and elves. That's what they think of your belief. Next, they say that since there is no God, there are no God-given inalienable rights, as John Locke said and as our Declaration of Independence says. Remember, Declaration of Independence says we have inalienable rights to pursuit of life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness. That comes directly from John Locke, who is a committed Christian. Well, if there are no God-given inalienable rights, The fact that it's inalienable means that God, that the government cannot take it away from you. Then the only rights we have, according to progressives, are the ones that the government gives to us. And if the government gives us this right, then the government can take it away as well. Next, they believe, like Karl Marx did, that man needs salvation. But it has to be an earthly salvation. And for them, that means an economic salvation. If we look back here, let me give you a code word that they use. A fair economy. That's an economy where everybody, and this is what they say, you read their website, everybody receives the same amount of money every year, no matter what your job is, no matter if you're working or not. Climate justice, that's just a way of redistributing wealth from America to other countries. And they use these deceptive phrases. So this is what they're after. And the whole point is they want to have an economic salvation for man so that everybody on the planet receives the same amount of money. Therefore, in order to achieve this economic salvation, there's only one institution that can provide it. God doesn't exist, so it must be government. And therefore, to enable government to do this, they have to take away all of our rights and give government unlimited powers. So progressives are always about increasing the power of government and taking away your individual liberties. Now, why are progressives conducting this war on religious liberty? Well, as I mentioned at the 9:30 talk, it is really a spiritual struggle. Remember what Ephesians 6:12 tells us. For our struggle is not against flesh and blood, but against the rulers, against the powers, against the world forces of darkness, against the spiritual forces of wickedness in the heavenly places. And progressive professors across America, and I have a whole bookcase full of their books, talk about the need to get rid of the First Amendment so that we can get rid of Christians as a political force, because Christians they identify as the primary political obstacle to their all-powerful government. Now, how are they waging the war on religious liberty? I've been involved in some of these cases. The cases involve seven different types of strategies that they've used so far. First, they use executive orders, which, by the way, are unconstitutional, but they use executive orders to shut down churches. You may remember Gavin Newsom shut down more than 3,000 Christian churches while leaving the liquor stores open because of COVID two summers ago. Second, they used the courts to outlaw any Christian influences in our schools. In our public schools, they get cases from the Supreme Court saying you cannot have a Bible in the school, you cannot have the Ten Commandments on the wall, you cannot have prayers in your school, even at your football games. In religious schools, they've started attacking them now. And it's very clever what they've done. They understand that if they can control the faculty in our Christian schools, then they will be able to control what's taught there. So they use discrimination statutes, saying that these religious schools are discriminating against non-Christians in hiring, and that violates civil rights laws. So they use that to try to corrupt our Christian schools and bring in non-believing teachers. Third, they use the courts to outlaw Christian influences in the public square. If there's a monument on the state capitol grounds of the Ten Commandments, it has to go. If the Brandenburg Cross case, a large cross that was in a veteran cemetery, it has to go. You can't have any mention of Christianity in any of our public buildings or in any of our public meetings, so you get rid of prayers at public meetings. Next, they use government regulations to destroy Christian businesses. The company that we know as Hobby Lobby is owned by Christians. They're big supporters of the Bible Museum in Washington, D.C., and they're very successful and are very generous with Christian organizations. They were fined by the Obama administration, $475 million a year, every year. What was their crime? They refuse to provide drugs that cause abortions to their female employees. My university, the next thing they do is they go after Christian universities. My university, Houston Baptist University, we were fined $12 million a year for the same reason. And these abortion-causing drugs are very easy. You can go to any doctor and get them. The point was not to force us to give abortion-causing drugs. The point was to force us to bend our knee and abandon our Christian faith. The $12 million fine year after year after year would have put us out of existence. That fine is more than the combined salaries of all of our professors each year. Little Sisters of the Poor, a group of Christian, of Roman Catholic nuns, 65 years old on average. They were fined $2.5 million a year because they wouldn't provide abortion-causing drugs to their 65-year-old nuns in their health care plan. Okay, and $2.5 million would have put them out of existence. What do? They live at poverty levels so that they can help old, elderly, poor people to have a dignified place to die. That's their home ministry worldwide. And the Obama administration wanted to put them out of existence. Next, they use government regulate after universities. They use the course to destroy the livelihoods of faithful Christians. I skipped over that one. But that's the case of Jack Phillips, and you may know the Masterpiece Cake Shop case in Colorado. A man asked a Christian baker to make a cake for a gay wedding, and he declined politely to do it. So the state of Colorado pursued the man and hassled him for years, imposed a $250,000 a year fine on him, not because he discriminated, but according to their own opinion, because he was a Christian. He had to go to the U.S. Supreme Court to get his rights vindicated. HBU, we had to go to the U.S. Supreme Court to get our rights vindicated. Hobby Lobby had to go to the U.S. Supreme Court to get their rights vindicated under the First Amendment. And then lastly, the newest thing that they do is the only way that HBU and the Little Sisters of the Poor, who were co-defendants with us in our case, and Hobby Lobby were able to win their cases was because when the Supreme Court took away strict scrutiny protection from our religious liberty, Congress stood in the gap and passed a law giving us the same religious liberty, strict scrutiny standard that the First Amendment, the text, gives to us. But it's only a statute. And now a statute has been passed by the Progressive Caucus in the House of Representatives that takes that statute away, or religious protections away under that. Right now, that bill is pending in the Senate Judiciary Committee. So if you want to write a letter, please write letters to your congressmen and to your senators about this terrible bill, because once that statute goes through, then we're left without religious liberty. Now, in closing, that's Jack Phillips there. So in closing, what would America look like if we lost our religious liberty? Well, the Bible tells us what it might look like. In one of the saddest stories I know, that's recorded in 2 Kings and 2 Chronicles. And this is a story that happened in Judah in 695 BC. The Bible tells us that an evil king came to power. His name was Manasseh. And Manasseh brought a lot of false religions, including worship of Baal, into Israel. And the people followed it. But Manasseh did something else as well. He sought out every copy of the law of the Lord, every copy of scripture that he could find, and he destroyed it. He ruled for 50 years, and during this time, Israel turned away from the Lord. Now, when he died, he's replaced by King Josiah, often called Good King Josiah when I was in Sunday school. And Josiah, when the temple was 300 years old, 20 years after Manasseh's death, he ordered that the temple be renovated and freshened up. So the high priest, the Bible tells us, goes into the treasure room of the temple, where apparently they had not been for many years, and he finds a scroll. And the high priest didn't know what the scroll was. And the Bible tells us that that scroll was probably the original scroll that Moses wrote giving the law of the Lord. It was the last remaining copy of Hebrew scripture in all of Israel. Now, the good news is that Josiah read it, or when it was read to him by a scribe, the Bible tells us he tore his clothes and started a program to bring back a renaissance of the true faith in Israel. But it was too late. And God delayed the punishment that he was going to give Judah until after Josiah died. But shortly after then, in 586 BC, Nebuchadnezzar and the Babylonians conquered Jerusalem and Israel and Judah, and the people were taken into captivity. Now, think about what it would be like to be a Jew, and you have been brought out of slavery and delivered miracle after miracle after miracle that we have through Exodus, and this wonderful land of milk and honey is delivered unto your hands against all odds. And the God who did this was always faithful to you. You've not only breached your covenant with him, your promises that you made, but you've also allowed your scripture to be taken away. And I want to ask you this. If we allow the progressive movement to take away our scripture and our faith and our religious liberty, are we any less to blame than the Jews were for what happened there? But America doesn't have to be like Judah. Thomas Jefferson once said, and my favorite quote from him, that truth is mighty. Truth is great. Truth has nothing to fear in the contest of ideas, and truth will always prevail so long as its voice can be heard. Christian education is more important today than it has ever been in our history. And I mean Christian education of your children at home, Christian education under preachers like you have here with Alex, Christian education in your schools, and Christian education in universities. It's never been more important because that's the last voice of truth in the wilderness of our modern world. Now at HBU, this is a picture I took yesterday of a new building that we're going to open in just a couple of weeks. We were able to raise $35 million for a Center for Law and Liberty. It's a five-building complex, and I'm going to be privileged to teach constitutional law to a new generation of lawyers and judges that are coming through our classrooms. I'll be able to teach it in the exact room where the Constitution was actually drafted. In the last 6 years, we've placed HBU students into 42 separate law schools, and several of our students have won full scholarships to top 10 law schools in the country. Now, this is a picture of our students in front of a house in Concord, Massachusetts. This is a house that belonged to a man named William Smith, Captain William Smith. He was the commander of the Minutemen at Concord, and these were the men who fired the shot heard around the world that began the American Revolution. At HBU, we've started a new legal revolution to produce a new generation of lawyers and judges that will preserve and expand our religious liberty. And I call on you to do everything you can with regard to your friends and everyone you talk to spread the word, to try to raise their sensitivity to what's going on in our country right now. Lastly, we're told in the Bible that we should be a ready advocate for the hope that is in us. The scholars at the Center for Law and Liberty have published a book that outlines the Christian origins of our founding principles. It's written by scholars, and it's a scholarly work, but it's written in for the general public so that it's easy to understand. I've brought a number of copies here for y'all for free. They're in the foyer if you'd like to pick one up at the end. If you're not able to get one of those, then you can obtain this on Amazon.com. So thank you for letting me visit with you today. I appreciate being here. And boy, I wish I could move to Fredericksburg and still teach where I teach. Thank you very much.